1st of June in London. Lord Godwin, oral history interview. Reading your book, which has been at my hand for some months, it says that the first reference to a Foreign Office assignment pointing in the UN's direction seems to have come in the summer of 1942, when you were assigned to something called Economic and Reconstruction Department. Do you have any memory of that, and do you have any sense of, at the time, of where it might lead?
Well, I was secretary to the head of the Foreign Office in the war when war broke out, and after the collapse of France, I was seconded to the Minister of Economic Warfare to help run the Special Operations Executive for Dr. Dalton. And that went on until Dr. Dalton went to the Board of Trade in April 1942. And I returned to the Foreign Office. And after a time, two or three months, they put me in charge of a new department called the Economic and Reconstruction Department, which was supposed to cope with various post-war problems, notably economic. But after a time, it became apparent that this was the economic future could not be dissociated from the political one, and therefore it became more and more obvious that what was needed and what actually took place was a kind of planning department in the Foreign Office, which I was the head, and I recruited more or less the staff. And after a time, I obtained the services of Professor Webster, who was at that time working in Chatham House and as a great expert on the League of Nations. And I made friends with him, and with some difficulty, got him inserted into the department. That must have been about perhaps nearly a year later. But even before then, we had been thinking about what might happen after the war in the way of an international organization. And he, of course, was very useful in preparing documents to that effect. And as you know, it's all down on paper, of course, this. And
oh, yes.
No particular reason for me to rehearse it.
Well, I'm listening because I'm really going to ask about your own temperament. You, that duty put you in touch not only with Lord Webster, but also with Keynes.
Not Lord Webster, no, he wasn't
Not Lord, I'm sorry. Lord Keynes he was already, wasn't he?
Keynes I only saw once or twice.
Yes. And Harry White later on.
No, I never met him.
Never?
No.
But it led, that initiative led, did it not, to Bretton Woods eventually?
No, I don't do Bretton Woods.
Really?
No,
it didn't go that way.
No.
My question is really, do you feel yourself to have been an economic animal, basically, or a political one?
Oh, political, of course.
I always thought so.
Yes.
Political is the impression that others have received.
Yeah.
Another aspect of the work eventually resulted in UNRRA, the Rehabilitation and Reconstruction Agency. Do you recall some of the arguments and some of the concepts around that? Was it a big Foreign Office issue?
Well, the Foreign Office had a say in it, but mostly the work of Sir Frederick Leith Ross, I seem to remember. And yes, we knew about it and encouraged it, and we thought that it was the first beginning of some kind of United Nations organization. It was the first United Nations organization to be formed, really. But it was evident that it couldn't work except with some political background, and it was so evident that we then passed on from there to the political background necessary.
Right. The big political issue of, I mean, there were a cluster of issues during the wartime. This emerges from your book. It emerges also from the Cadogan Diaries and others. Was it your thought, or was it Foreign Office thought, I must say it was echoed also in Washington and Moscow, that the three powers, US, UK, and the Soviet Union, and perhaps added to that a revived France, was going to lay down the post-war law for everybody, or did you frankly foresee a day when other countries would share the responsibilities?
Well, there wasn't such a thing as a Foreign Office view. The people of the Foreign Office were quite divided, I think, on all these issues quite often. But we tried to get a Foreign Office consensus, this is true, in order to advise the Secretary of State. And I suppose I was fairly successful in getting such consensus, probably. And no, we thought, I think, the original four-power plan was that there should be a basis of four-power agreement, without which agreement it was unlikely we would ever have an international organization at all. Naturally, nobody thought that there would be the other powers would be excluded, but it was thought that unless there was harmony between the greater powers, the future was pretty dim, which indeed it has proved to be.
You've just really, in a way, haven't you, mapped out the idea of permanent membership of the Security Council?
Yes, that was the original idea.
Did you grow from that? I mean, did the veto and the five permanent members of the Security Council grow out of this?
Yes, I suppose so. Yes, undoubtedly it did. Dumbarton Oaks. Yes, yes.
Who were the other personalities who were at this point perhaps less interested in the day-to-day conduct of the war and how whether things were going badly or not on the battlefronts, and who were really caring about the shape of the post-war world? You were the first foremost among them, but you must have had somebody to argue with.
Well, the great leader, Mr. Churchill, eventually had some ideas about world government, but most of the time he was much too preoccupied in winning the war to think seriously about the matters.
I think he was also bored with the whole UN thing.
I think he had an idea, sort of his own ideas, of course, as I say in my book, were laid down in the morning thoughts to be had. That was later on. First of all, he didn't really have much, he didn't pay much attention to these things, I don't think.
Tell me, you served under various foreign secretaries, including Halifax, Eden, and I suppose Bevin afterwards. Do you remember any of the personality differences or concords with them? Did you get on well with Halifax, for example?
Yes, I didn't work all that closely with Halifax, as I was Secretary of the Foreign Office, head of the Foreign Office, and Cadogan had a special relationship with Halifax. I didn't really advise Halifax directly at all. Yes, I suppose so. I got on well with him, but that was that. Then he was succeeded by Eden,
yes,
with whom I never really got on very well. No, I didn't really, because he was, as I thought, not very interested in the future. He was a very good negotiator and interested in what was going to happen the day after tomorrow and how he could get hold of
Prime Minister
to succeed and how he could make his views prevail in some conference, which is he was a very good negotiator and a very good foreign secretary in many ways, but he was bored with the future, I think, and never really contemplated that much and seriously. Certainly he never really paid very much attention to our views on world government. He accepted it in principle, but he didn't really know about it.
It's an interesting phrase you've just used, because there are many people who feel that the UN Charter, as it was written at San Francisco, is in entirely the opposite direction from world government. It reinforces sovereignty to a tremendous degree. Do you agree about that or not?
I never thought that world government was a practical possibility.
No, I know, but you used the phrase. That's why I... You meant the governance of the world.
I meant that, I suppose, world organization.
Yes. Let me ask, one of the interesting things that comes up in the correspondence between Churchill and Roosevelt is the question of whether China is a world power or not. I'm talking about 1943, 44, 45. Did you have any feelings on that subject?
Well, we in the Foreign Office generally, I think, never thought that it was that China had any chance of being a real world power for a very long time. But we had to imagine that it was a world power in order to please President Roosevelt. And the whole object was to get agreement with the Americans. And that was one of the reasons why we agreed with the idea that China should come in as a great power.
But you had no illusions about the...
Well, not whatever. We thought that it was very unlikely that they'd emerge as a world power for a very considerable time.
Well, of course, they have, haven't they?
Well, after 30 years, yes.
Interesting, incidentally, I'm leaping forward now, but in the period of 1950 to 54, when you were in the UK permanent rep at the Security Council, you then had the rather difficult task of threading a path between your country's recognition of Peking and the U.S. abhorrence of the very idea. So you must have found that rather difficult.
I don't know about that. The United States very nearly recognized Communist China soon after Mr. Bevin did. That is, when Atchison came to London in the beginning of 48, I think it was, wasn't it?
No, I can't.
He was just on the point of recognizing when there was some incident in Peking,
Missionaries
murdered or something, and the China lobby got up in arms, and then they went right back against the idea. But it was a pity, but that was so. When I was in New York, if we can talk about that, that was in 1950.
Hmm.
I did, when President of the Security Council, succeed in getting the Americans to agree by abstaining to the Red Chinese sending a mission to New York.
General Wu, I remember
General
him.
Wu, yes, as I say.
Although, that was towards the end of the year. I was in Korea at that time.
Oh, you were?
As the UN man. UN information officer.
Yes.
But still, it must have been not easy for the principal ally of the United States to hold, especially when China came into the fighting, a view so entirely opposite to that of the Americans.
Well, it wasn't entirely opposite, I suppose, to some Americans anyway.
But this was the physical enemy, armed and horrible, on the battlefield.
Yes, the Chinese. Yes. Well, we did our best, and I think we succeeded in modifying the American policy to some extent. I should have thought.
What about India? Were you convinced that the American attitude to India as certainly a country that should be spoken about as independent now, whatever the technicalities remaining to be accomplished, and as a potential power of importance in the United Nations, did you feel that that was an incursion or a violation of...
What year are you referring to?
I'm talking about the war years, when America...
The end of the war? India wasn't independent until 49. Well,
that's right. On the other hand, she had a separate UN vote
as a member of the Commonwealth. Yes.
But did you hold that American encouragement of Indian independence was intrusion into British affairs?
No, I didn't personally. No,
I'm interested in you personally, but the whole interview is pitched at what you felt, because in the open now, isn't it?
I thought that they'd have to recognize India was completely independent, yes. But it needed some time for India to settle down as a considerable power, and eventually it did, certainly. Whether she should have been a member of the Security Council, but it was a permanent member, was a different matter.
Done, yeah. Well,
I think it had been difficult, really, with Pakistan before the Indians found their feet.
But you had no misgivings yourself about the idea of India as a separate nation?
No, whatever. No.
Interesting. I was trying to work out, very hard to find out. I couldn't, checked a few references, but the Indian, how did the Indian separate vote come about? Do you have any ideas? It's something
separate
that...
Separate vote?
I mean, India was the only non-dominion, to use the term of the time, which had a separate vote in the United Nations.
I can't remember.
It's interesting. I must check it. It's,
can't remember.
The Indians didn't know. I asked them. Now, if we could look at the war for a bit. When 1944 came, and we've all got certain that the Germans were going to be beaten, there was a debate about the future of Germany. Should it be partitioned? Should it be a single country? Unconditional surrender? You remember the Morgenthau business. What was your own view about the future of Germany at that time? Do you remember?
Well, I had a great, I think there was a division of opinion in the Foreign Office, I can't remember exactly what it was, but the official view was that at all costs Germany should be reunited as a democracy, I never thought that was very likely because the Russians being in possession of half Germany wouldn't agree. Whether we thought it was a good thing or not, I thought it was the only thing to do was to count on the possibility that the likelihood that half Germany, or three quarters or two thirds of Germany, would be in the Western camp, and the other would be in the Eastern camp. And I thought that was maybe unfortunate, but it was inevitable.
Mm.
And that the idea of always saying that we had to have the Wiedervereinigung Deutschlands as the principal objective was probably mistaken.
Was there, do you remember anything about other opinions in the Foreign Office?
Oh yes, there was. I think I said so. There was. I think I can't remember the name of the chap, but he was.
Well, Vansittart, of course, was.
Who?
Robert Vansittart. Vansittart.
Oh, that was he. He didn't have any.
He was out by this stage.
Yes, yes.
He was the great pre-war hater of Germany.
No, there was nothing to do with that at the end of the war. But there were people who thought that the idea was that we must have a united democratic Germany, and that was the principal objective of our foreign policy, but I didn't think myself it would be so.
Tell me, on a different level, what working for Cadogan was like, or working with him. Because
well, I thought I worked very well with him. And
no doubt you did. The diaries, of course, reveal that under the urbane exterior there were banked fires of fury.
I never knew anything about that myself, very old.
Really?
No, nothing whatever.
I thought to his close colleagues he would occasionally explode.
No, he was always very calm, I assure you. That's extraordinary.
Amazing, isn't it? You must have read the book with some astonishment then.
Well, I did, really, yes, yes. But he was an extremely able operator.
Oh, very.
And very astute and very judgmatical, I thought, in all his judgments. I thought he was a very good man.
Says that swine Samuel Hoare going to Madrid as ambassador, good riddance to bad rubbish.
Well, he couldn't bear Sam Hoare, it's quite true.
Yes, well, a few others he couldn't bear either. He seems, if you look at the diaries carefully, he seems to have started out with an initial resistance to Churchill and then a slow acceptance.
That's true. Yes, he became rather dominated by Churchill eventually, I think. But he always tended to criticize him too, yes.
He was your predecessor, of course, in New York, wasn't he?
Yes, but he'd left for the time of the Korean War. He was on his way back in a ship when the Korean War broke out. Otherwise, they might have asked him to keep on and stay on, I suppose. But anyhow, he was on his way back on a ship, and so I had to go out at a moment's notice. And I got there 2 days after the war had broken out.
And the day after that, I took off for Korea.
What?
Yes, the day after that, I left New York.
Oh, really?
Bound
yes.
for Korea with Colonel Katzen, who was Trygve Lie's representative.
Uh-huh.
And but I remember those two Security Council meetings, and I was back in October for some of those ones where you had some fun.
No, the principal decisions have been taken before I got there.
Yes, June the 25th and 27th.
Was it
the main ones? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But then when the Chinese came in and General Wu and arrived and so on...
Well, he went back without any satisfaction. He went back. He stayed with the Russians and went back. So no.
Yes, I remember. But you became, at that stage, something of a national figure, and really in the next year, on television in America, because...
Yes, in September, August, September of 50 years, and to some extent afterwards.
And you became a considerable folk hero for...
So I believe, yes, yes.
You must have found that for a Foreign Office chap to have been an unusual...
Pretty odd.
All right, we march on. Anonymity in documents. You look at something like the Atlantic Charter, and you wonder, was it really the work of Cadogan?
I suppose so, but it all happened on a ship, I seem to remember, and I wasn't there.
He must have taken copious files aboard with him, I'm sure.
No, I don't think so.
Really?
No. No, I think he drafted it, but under the influence of Churchill and Roosevelt, of course. And... It was all vague when it got
freedom from want.
Well, it was all right, but it didn't have much effect on the future of the Atlantic Charter, I don't think.
Rather interestingly, I was looking at it, 8 main points, of which one looked to the establishment of a peace that would meet all nations, quote, a means of dwelling in safety within their own boundaries, free from fear and want. Then I was going to ask, whose ideas were they? Do you think they were Churchill's, as put down by Cadogan?
Well, I think Roosevelt's ideas were those. I don't know. I wasn't there.
No. And as you say, there was no desk work before.
Oh, no, at all. It was just done, I think, in the consciousness. I don't think they had any files much on the ship.
Heavens. Article 7 of that charter called for the right to cross the high seas and oceans without hindrance.
That was Roosevelt, of course.
That was Roosevelt. The British view, historically at least, has been that we're entitled to seize and search in wartime, aren't
we? Yes, I think that was so.
Interestingly, the Charter of the United Nations seems to have nothing about freedom of navigation and the right to cross the seas.
No.
Tell me, as you look at the unfolding of things since, do you believe that if things had been done differently back then, that the world might be different today?
It's like saying, what would happen if Napoleon had won the Battle of Waterloo?
Well, it is, I grant you.
Anything might have happened, I quite agree. But
yeah, but it's an entertaining game, you can enter on with a very small stake. So you have no...
Well, I don't think it was very likely that things would have turned out very differently, given the fact that there was almost bound to be a clash between the Americans and the Russians.
Let's analyze that for a moment. The Russians have this hedgehog fear of being assaulted from the West, and they have some reason historically to have such an outlook. Do you think there was American-British insensitivity to this psychological need of theirs, or
no, what? I think the British were very conscious of it.
But couldn't sell the Americans?
The Americans I think, much more keen on them. Well, the Americans were under Harry Hopkins. I beg your pardon, I kind of got it wrong. The Americans were
conscious.
Absolutely keen on getting agreement with the Russians at all costs, yes. And the British were more doubtful whether that would work.
And eventually, of course, what happened was the Americans, the worst possible outcome, wasn't it? I mean, it really, not the worst possible, war would have been worse, but really the greatest suspicion on both sides and a kind of mounting temperature.
I think the Russians were largely responsible for that, of course, true, but perhaps it was inevitable.
Tell me why, if you know why. Why would it have been in the Russian interest to set up this wall or to project hostility and suspicion and dislike? Is there do you have any views on this? Do you have any?
Well, the Russians, having absorbed their empire and their glacis, were frightened that it would be disrupted by American action or Western action, and they still are.
Yes, I suppose so. We have and we hold, like Fafner in The Ring. Churchill notes that at Tehran in December 1943, there I sat with the great Russian bear on one side of me with paws outstretched, and on the other side the great American buffalo. I guess he must have thought a little while before coming up with the buffalo as a symbol of America. And between the two sat the poor little English donkey, who was the only one who knew the right way home. What do you feel about that?
I guess that's an exaggerated way of putting it. But I think that at Tehran, it was evident that the Russians and the Americans between themselves are going to dominate the scene, and we had far less influence than we had before.
You were around, no, you weren't actually in, you were in London when the atomic thing happened and the Baruch Lilienthal plan and the Russian rejection and whatnot. A lot of people today feel that the Acheson Baruch Lilienthal plan, as presented to the council in, what was it, 46?
Baruch plan.
But it was really Lilienthal's initially, as amended by Acheson.
Oh, yeah.
And finally put up by Baruch. We are here to make a choice between the quick and the dead. It's an empty phrase, isn't it? But that was calculated to bring about a Russian rejection, because it ensured an American monopoly of control. Do you feel that there's
anything? Well, you couldn't get over the question of control, really.
Meaning?
That was a basic difficulty.
There was no one willing to trust an independent.
Well, I don't think the Russians
authority.
Were willing to trust.
Well, the Americans.
No, the Americans either. No.
Well, then we had then it was a problem, obviously.
Yes.
Cadogan, I don't know where this goes, but let's see. Cadogan observed in 1944 that he didn't trust, quote, a nice, complete, logical charter which won't mean what it says. Much better, frankly, say that for 5 years the three powers must run the world. They're the only people who can. Do you really believe that even then that decisions affecting all the continents could be made by this trio of deciding powers? Or were you skeptical, more particularly about the UK's economic future, if not for her, if not of her imperial influence?
I thought that if there was going to be any success in the United Nations, the Americans and the Russians would have to be in broad agreement, otherwise the thing wouldn't work.
But you weren't very sanguine about there being such an agreement even then?
Not after 1947, no.
What changed?
Well, it was quite evident that the Russians were not going to play that game.
I'm really interested and will put careful questions unless you can find me a shortcut. I am interested in some of the personalities of the time. Do you have any outstanding? I mean, you gave me a little insight into Eden's priorities when he took over the foreign secretaryship. Now, what about Halifax? He was, you didn't have too much to do with him personally. You worked through Cadogan.
Yes.
And Cadogan is rather reticent on
is he?
On Halifax. I'm having an argument with Robert Rhodes James. Do you know him? He's the.
I hardly know him. I know of him. Yes.
He says that Eden was going to be Secretary General. I can't believe that
no,
for a moment.
No.
He believes it, apparently. There's a reference to it in his printed memoirs. But
I don't think there's any question of it. I don't think Eden wanted it.
Well, he wanted Churchill to go away so he could be Prime Minister, didn't he?
Oh, of course. Yes.
The other thing which someone must have realised was that the last British Secretary General of the League, Eric Drummond, having finished his spell in Geneva, was brought home, ennobled.
No, he wasn't ennobled. He inherited it.
Oh, I see. And sent to Rome to be ambassador.
Yes.
Where they'd just been visiting sanctions.
That's right. The base has anything to do.
Wasn't it? Hold on. I've got to turn this thing over. Are you distressed at this procedure? You all right?
What?